Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
This public radio podcast is supported by Constellation Energy, a global provider of fuels, power, and energy services, committed to environmentally sound, energy efficient, and sustainable energy solutions. Constellation Energy, the way energy works. And by Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Maybe it's time to stop worrying and learn to love Wall Street. The Fed cuts interest rates? Sure, let's send the Dow up 400 points and then down 300. Bear Stearns goes bust? Okay, let's buy some shares. And, you know, don't even get me started on the mortgage markets. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Grant Thornton, serving their audit, tax, and advisory clients worldwide with people who love what they do. Online at grantthornton.com. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us on this Wednesday. Today is the 19th of March. That makes it about 72 hours since the Federal Reserve saved the world. All right, I exaggerate, but that was the mindset on Wall Street the early part of this week. By bailing out Bear Stearns, the theory went, the Fed kept the financial markets together. J.P. Morgan got quite a deal at $2 a share for the busted brokerage house. So how can it possibly be that Bear Stearns traded today at better than $5 for a virtually worthless company? Top shareholders at Bear are said to be looking for another bidder, one that could force the price even higher. But that may or it may not explain why the stock is so popular. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
Hope springs eternal, apparently, among Bear Stearns' biggest stockholders, and technically it's not a done deal. They could still line up the votes to reject the takeover bid from J.P. Morgan. But at Stanford University, securities law professor Joseph Grunfest says others have an incentive to buy the stock for the opposite reason, so they can cast more votes for the deal.
The bondholders of Bear Stearns are going to be covered by J.P. Morgan in this transaction. If the transaction fails, you lose all the money that you have invested in the Bear Stearns bonds.
Today, Reuters quoted a well-placed source as saying J.P. Morgan does not plan to adjust the terms of the deal. So absent a rival bid, which most analysts consider highly unlikely, what might cause J.P. Morgan to budge?
If one looks out over the horizon, you could imagine shareholders giving up litigation claims. You could imagine a wide variety of other forms of resolution that could rationally persuade J.P. Morgan to increase the amount that it pays. But as a practical matter, why would J.P. Morgan give up something for nothing?
Across the country at Columbia University, securities law professor John Coffey says stockholders might eke out a dollar or two more, but there are limits to how far they can push.
The immediate problem for Bear Stearns is if they can't find a bidder or simply negotiate a higher price with J.P. Morgan, and if J.P. Morgan's offer is rejected, it's quite possible it would be in bankruptcy in a few days where they don't even get $2 a share.
Beyond that, one Wall Street analyst suggested today the idea of a white knight is pure fairy tale. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
The housing market got a $200 billion shot in the arm today. Federal regulators eased off what are called capital reserve requirements for the two big government-sponsored mortgage underwriters. That'd be Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. It'll let them use the extra money to buy up more debt. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale explains how it's all going to work.
The government has already lifted the caps on Fannie and Freddie's mortgage holdings and raised the size of mortgages they can underwrite. Add today's relaxed capital requirements, and the twins can inject an additional $2 trillion into the mortgage market this year. Freddie's Executive Vice President Patricia Cook says some of the new money will be used to refinance troubled subprime loans.
And those mortgages that we have already guaranteed, we are in a position now to be even more aggressive about modifying those loans. And hopefully by doing that, we will influence others to follow suit.
Since the government backs up Fannie and Freddie's mortgage underwriting, some worry about taking on riskier loans with an even thinner cash cushion. Tom LaMalfa is an industry analyst with Wholesale Access Research and Consulting.
The agencies are going to be assuming additional risk at the same time that their capital base has been decreased. And it does make Fannie and Freddie a bit more vulnerable because they are very highly leveraged agencies.
But Freddie's Patricia Cook says allowing struggling homeowners to default on their loans hurts lenders even more than working out easier payment terms.
So you could look at loan modifications for us as a risk or loss minimizing activity.
As for new mortgages, Cook says with all the attention to lending risks, the credit quality of new loans are substantially better than they were a year ago. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
The hope is those new loans will get the housing market healthy again, and pronto, too. Cheaper mortgages are the other thing you'd think would help, and in a perfect world, when the Fed cuts its interest rates, mortgage rates would fall, too. As of last week, the average 30-year fixed-rate mortgage was slightly more than 6%, actually higher than in the beginning of January. What gives? Here's Jeremy Hobson.
If I'm a bank, why in the world would I want to lend to you right now? I'm cash-strapped, and with the economy heading into a recession, you may be too. Sorry to say this, but just the thought of giving you a loan frightens me.
That sort of fear will always drive up any interest rate, including a mortgage rate.
Princeton economist Alan Blinder says the fear of default is the number one reason why the Federal Reserve isn't having a big impact on fixed-rate mortgages. Number two, says economist Morris Davis at the University of Wisconsin, is that the Fed's rate cuts are bound to reverse as the economy turns around.
In, say, 2 years' time, we're no longer going to be in a recession. And then the Federal Reserve Board should start raising interest rates.
So he says banks have no interest in getting people into loans that could last 30 years at low, low interest rates. That said, the rates on some shorter-term loans do correlate more with the federal funds rate, things like home equity loans and some adjustable-rate mortgages. But, says Dolores Conway at the University of Southern California's Lusk Center for Real Estate,
the Fed is not really lowering interest rates just so that mortgage rates can go down and people can either stay in their homes or buy homes. They actually have the interests of the broader economy at heart.
In other words, with unemployment rising, a spreading credit crunch, and growing concerns about inflation, the Fed now has bigger things to worry about than your monthly mortgage payments. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Energy prices are one thing we know the Fed's keeping an eye on. Nothing like triple-digit oil prices to get inflation going. Crude actually fell today, though, all off almost $5, 4.5% to $104.48 a barrel. Gold lost its shine by more than $50. That's about 6%. None of that mattered at the corner of Wall Street and Broad, though traders gave back most of yesterday's rally. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Maybe the only thing about the war in Iraq that everybody can agree on is that it's been expensive. But even then, 5 years on, it's virtually impossible to find the definitive price tag. We've called economist Stephen Davis at the University of Chicago to talk about how to come up with that final accounting. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
The figures you see for this war range from the several hundred billion dollars up to $3 to $4 trillion or more. I'm wondering if you have a rule of thumb. Or a baseline that you use?
I think you can start with the appropriations to date and take that as a lower bound. Because what the appropriations to date, and I think those are in the range of $600 to $700 billion. The reason I say they're a lower bound is because they do not fully capture the value of medical services that will be required for seriously injured veterans. They do not capture the impact on the cost of oil. So take that number as a lower bound. You start adding in these other figures, and I think you get pretty close to something like $1 trillion. Many of the higher cost figures you see bandied about include a much higher cost for estimated future costs of medical care and so on.
Assuming, though, that it is a big number, I'm wondering if you could help us assess maybe what the real economic effects of that expenditure might be back here.
Well, I think it means higher taxes in some present value sense for Americans, either now or to the extent that the war is financed by deficit spending, than higher taxes in the future.
Otherwise, we don't much notice. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I wouldn't put it quite that way. There's certainly profound effects on those who have served in the military, particularly those who either themselves or have family members who've lost a life or suffered some grievous injury. But for most Americans, the main impact is going to be through the impact on their wallet, higher taxes now or in the future.
The president in his speech today talked a little bit about the costs of the war, and he said, in essence, it's been worth it, and had we done nothing, we would have still been in danger. I'm wondering if there's a way to assess the negative proposition, that is, the cost of the war versus the costs of what, containing Saddam Hussein and maintaining a posture there?
Well, two colleagues of mine, Kevin Murphy and Robert Topel at the University of Chicago, carried out a study that sought to address exactly that question. Our baseline estimate of what that would have cost in present value terms was about $300 billion. Now, $300 billion is a lot less, I think, than we've spent on the war to date. We also sought to take into account some of the concerns that critics of containment had expressed before the war. And I think even in our more pessimistic scenarios, the kinds of cost figures we came up with were in the range of $700 billion. I think at this point it's pretty clear that even in the very best case scenario, the path we've gone down is going to be more costly than that.
You know, critics of the war, Professor, will say, listen, what we ought to be doing is not prosecuting this war and spending all this money. We ought to take all these hundreds of billions of dollars and spend it here on infrastructure and health care and education. Is that an apples-to-apples comparison?
It's certainly a correct observation in the sense that there is an opportunity cost to the resources that we've devoted to the war. On the other hand, I don't think we want to think about the U.S. devotes nothing to military expenditures in the Persian Gulf. No matter what the United States does in Iraq proper, we will be devoting large military resources to securing some type of stability and protection for the interests of the United States and its allies in the Middle East.
Stephen Davis is professor of economics at the Graduate School of Business at the University of Chicago. Professor, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Wall Street's been getting all the attention as the mortgage mess tightens its grip, but you don't have to look too far afield to find other problems. State budgets are sliding into the red as property values tumble and tax revenues dry up. So governors and legislatures are looking for quick fixes. Some of them have decided to roll the dice. They're considering selling or leasing their lotteries. The risks are low, no small thing these days, and the payout is quick. The governor of Vermont wants his state to be the first to take the bet. From Vermont Public Radio, John Dillon reports.
Joanne Gray is a regular at this convenience store in the capital city of Montpelier. She likes to play the lottery and usually takes a chance on Powerball.
Congratulations, you're a winner.
This time, her winnings were just $1. Gray says she buys tickets for fun and for the chance to make millions.
Why not? My chances are as good as anybody else's. Like to pay off a few bills if I could. But I have a grandson I'd like to see go to college. Powerball, we do it.
Like the lottery itself, the privatization proposals being shopped around to state governments promise fast cash. Vermont's Republican Governor Jim Douglas supports the idea. Right now, Vermont makes $23 million a year from the lottery. Douglas is on record as saying the state could get an additional $50 million up front by leasing the games to a private operator. Jeff Hyman is with J.P. Morgan Securities. The investment bank is one of several hoping to get a piece of the lottery action as state governments consider privatization. Hyman testified recently in Vermont.
There is extra value in this asset, and it is extractable. Dialogues like this are going on at numerous state capitals around the country.
Hyman says California, New York, Ohio, Florida, Texas, Illinois, and Indiana are all looking at selling or leasing their lotteries. States that sell or lease their lottery will give up control of a money-making asset. But in return, depending on the deal, they get an upfront payment and a guaranteed revenue stream. But the worry is a hyped-up lottery could get more people hooked on gambling. Philip Cook is a public policy professor at Duke University. He spells out the dilemma facing lawmakers.
My concern has been whether the increased sales would come through more aggressive marketing, maybe using messages and marketing schemes that would have the effect of getting people to spend more money.
Right now, Vermont closes its lottery ads with a cautionary message.
Please, play responsibly.
I won!
Losing control of the lottery could mean those warning messages would disappear. Democrats, who control the legislature, say they won't let that happen. Speaker of the House Gay Symington addressed the issue at a recent news conference.
I do not believe Vermonters are comfortable with either increasing the reliance on gambling to fund state government or selling Vermont to Wall Street.
But the state could be leaving money on the table. Jeff Hyman of J.P. Morgan said more aggressive sales could net the state a quick 10% gain in lottery revenues. Whatever Vermont or any other state decides to do, Hyman says they shouldn't do it just yet. The capital markets are soft and volatile right now, and problems in the municipal bond market have made investors nervous of anything to do with cities and states. Hyman says by summer, things should have settled, and state lotteries will look like a much better bet. In Montpelier, Vermont, I'm John Dillon for Marketplace.
Coming up, March Madness and the Man.
Friends of mine at other companies have pretty much watched every single game in their cube on their computer.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow slid 293 points today, 2.3% to close at 12,099. The Nasdaq slipped 58 points, 2.5% to 2209. The S&P 500 slipped 32 points, 2.4%, 1298, the number there. News that the government's going to pump $200 billion into the distressed mortgage market, pumped up Freddie Mac by nearly 15% and Fannie Mae nearly 9%. Energy and commodity shares were among the biggest losers, with Exxon losing 4.5%, Chevron falling nearly 5%, Alcoa dropped 7.75%, Newmont Mining drilled down 4.25% today. Bonds fell, the yield on the benchmark 10-year T-note rose to 3.33%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Advanta. Advanta salutes small business, the brave ones, the risk takers, all those who chase a dream and make their own way. And by the American Public Transportation Association, working toward energy independence with 10 billion transit trips per year at publictransportation.org. Every day's marketplace is put together the day of. If you want to get the show info as it's being created, sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It also includes upcoming special projects on the show. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Thursday. Belgium's new Prime Minister Yves Leterme will be sworn in by King Albert II. The Education Department holds a conference looking at the future of the No Child Left Behind Act. And Pittsburgh asks, "Won't you be my neighbor?" on its first ever Sweater Day, honoring what would have been Fred Rogers' 80th birthday. I'm Caitlin Carroll.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You know, with Wall Street and the economy all topsy-turvy, it's easy to see how Ben Bernanke might be sending mixed messages. Yes, he cut interest rates yesterday. The federal funds rate is now 2.25%, less than half of what it was when all the rate cutting started. But it wasn't 6 months ago he was warning us about the dangers of cheap money. Commentator David Frum says the Fed chairman might benefit from a history lesson or two.
If Ben Bernanke owns a Ouija board, this might be a good time to get Arthur Burns on the line. Burns was Fed chairman under Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford. In the early 1970s, he faced a situation spookily similar to that now confronting Bernanke. Inflation was accelerating. The dollar was dropping. Prices of oil, metals, grains, and other commodities were soaring. Every economic indicator on the central banker's console screamed for an increase in interest rates. But at the same time, the nation's troubled corporate sector clamored for rate cuts. In 1970, the Penn Central failed, the largest corporate bankruptcy in history. The shock threatened to tumble Penn's lenders and to wreck many of the new conglomerates assembled in the 1960s to mesmerize Wall Street by buying earnings growth. What to do? Burns chose an expansionary policy. He did what Bernanke is doing now. He cut and cut and cut again. The crisis of 1970-71 ended in a mild recession. But that did not end the story. Soon, prices were racing at double-digit rates. I still remember the little white stickers my family's favorite steakhouse used to overwrite the prices on last month's menu. The savage recession Burns hoped to avoid arrived anyway in 1974-75. In one of his memoirs, Milton Friedman recalls warning President Nixon against the easy money policy of 1970-71. He told the president, "Do you really want to do that? The only effect of that will be to leave you with a larger inflation if you do get reelected." Nixon answered, "Well, we'll worry about that after we get reelected." Nixon was reelected, and everybody was soon worrying about inflation. The inflation of the 1970s was not some natural disaster. It was the result of deliberate policy choices made by people as smart as we are today. If anything, they had more excuse for their mistakes. They could not learn from their own example. We can. The more shame on us if we repeat it.
David Frum is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. His latest book is called Comeback: Conservatism That Can Win Again. Send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Between rising medical costs and drug-resistant diseases, there's already plenty about health care to fret over. However, we're obliged to add another thing to the list today. More nurses are quitting. Nurses of a certain age, that is. New research shows more than a third of nurses born during the baby boom plan to retire or change jobs sometime in the next 3 years. Add in the chronic shortage of trained nurses, and that could leave hospitals in critical condition. From New York, Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
Trish Bernal is a registered nurse at Virginia Commonwealth University Health System. She qualifies for a state pension this year.
And also, I want some work-life balance. I'm at a point in my life, I have grandchildren, I have an aging mother.
She's one of many baby boomer nurses thinking of retiring soon. She says her hospital is very popular. It's got a lot to offer nurses wanting to further their careers. But still, there's a shortage.
I think that the patients who are in the hospital are sicker, and it's causing us to have a much smaller nurse-patient ratio, and there are periods of time where it's very difficult to fill positions.
She thinks nursing doesn't appeal to women the way it used to. She says they have so many more careers open to them than when she started. But Robert Rossiter of the American Association of Colleges of Nursing says there's no shortage of aspiring nurses. In fact, their numbers have grown.
Last year, we turned away 40,000 qualified applicants to nursing schools. Schools just do not have enough faculty to accommodate growing class sizes accordingly.
Rossiter says things will get worse as the population ages. He says we could have a nursing crisis within the next 15 years.
So if we're experiencing a shortage now, it's between 8 and 10% of the number of nurses needed. It's expected to grow to as much as 30% by the year 2020.
Right now, the U.S. imports a lot of nurses from abroad, but Rossiter says that's only a temporary solution since the nursing shortage is global. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
College basketball fans are teetering on the brink of nirvana this afternoon. The NCAA tournament starts tomorrow. March Madness means all basketball all the time, 64 teams, games every day, office betting pools, the whole deal. Even if you're not a fan, there may be no escaping it. And if you're running a business, well, that's a whole nother ballgame, as Stacey Vanek-Smith reports.
Here's what a distraction March Madness has become. CBS, which will stream all the games live on its website this year, has added a new feature, the boss button. Supervisor coming over? Click the button and it's goodbye big game, hello serious looking spreadsheet. That button could get a lot of use in the next few weeks. CBS predicts more than 2 million people will watch the games on their computers. Consulting firm Challenger Gray & Christmas says that could cost U.S. companies more than $1.5 billion in lost productivity. And, says Executive Vice President Rick Cobb, there's another problem with watching at work.
There are organizations that have to ban it just in order to be able to function because the amount of bandwidth that they would lose in their offices if they were allowed people to watch the games on their computers would bring the company to a screeching halt.
One company grappling with this is online real estate brokerage firm Redfin. The Seattle-based startup has about 100 employees in cities all over the country, and they all rely on one computer system. Redfin's IT department got worried that overzealous Hoops fans would crash the company's internet, so Redfin broker Lauren Ellingson helped gin up a solution.
What we're doing is we're going to project it on the screen out front is probably close to like 8 feet by 10 feet, and that's kind of our lobby area where we eat lunches. It should be a lot of fun.
Fellow broker and basketball fan Klaus Gosma says he thinks the basketball screening room will make workers more productive.
Friends of mine at other companies have pretty much watched every single game in their cube on their computer. And I think this way, you know, people won't be hiding in their office watching. If they're going to watch, they'll be doing it in an open public area.
But March Madness is not just about watching the games. It's about betting on them. Redfin software engineer Jamie DeMichael custom designed a March Madness web application for the office. People can use it to place their bets and track their picks.
I've been running a pool for about 9 years, and I decided to finally just make my own application. I'm pretty pleased with how it turned out.
I was the last one to know about any of this.
That's the boss, Redfin CEO Glenn Kelman.
The only reason I found out about all of it is because you're interviewing us. So I didn't know about the software application that we built for tracking the bracket. I didn't know about the pool. I didn't know about the projector. And it was really hard to find out who the ringleader was because we first had to convince him that he wouldn't get busted.
Kelman says when he found out, he couldn't believe how much effort had gone into planning for March Madness. And he says he was really impressed with DeMichael's work.
I mean, it's a fully interactive, very powerful web application for tracking the entire bracket. And really, it's some of his best work ever. It really is.
Kelman says all of the time and energy going into March Madness is a little disturbing, but he welcomes it. He says it makes Redfin a fun place to work and builds camaraderie. And, more to the point, he's a Tar Heels fan and wants to watch the games too. In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, what do you do when the economy is tanking and dragging your stock price down with it? Well, you throw more products at the customer, of course. That's the plan at Starbucks. The coffee company has announced plans for a new line of health and wellness products. There'll be some fancy new machines to make the espresso and a new coffee blend, too. But Starbucks isn't just expecting customers to buy and buy and buy some more. The most loyal of them will get free refills. Past and present CEO Howard Schultz talked up his plans to investors earlier today. He said the economy is in a, quote, tailspin, but he promised to pump up sales nonetheless. Wall Street was having none of it, thank you. Shares fell more than 4% today. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Wednesday. Today, the Dow fell 293 points, 2.3%. I guess they weren't so wild about that rate cut anyway. The Nasdaq lopped off 58 points, 2.5%. The S&P 500 sank 32 points, 2.4%. Robbie Carman, Stephen Colon, Nicole Imbornoni, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns engineered the program for us. Coming up next time, better carbon emissions through taxes.
So if you want to get a guaranteed reduction in the use of gasoline and therefore the use in greenhouse gases from that source of emissions, you might have to charge a dollar a gallon or more.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.